Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Duff Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most familiar work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
Whoa, Elliot, are you okay? It sounds like you've started hosting some kind of evil doom. thematic.
Yep. I was so inspired by Matthew in 10.z that I put some curses in my throat.
Yeah. Anyway, we're here to talk about Pale. It's a book by Wildbow, still being written, and it's pretty good. And we're going to talk about two of its chapters today, one after another 10.4 and one after another 10.z, was it? Yes, 10.z. Yes. Two very narratively hefty chapters, and I guess word count hefty. That 10.z was pretty long, wasn't it?
They're both like 14,000 words.
Damn.
Which is insane, because it's like the average ward chapter, I looked it up, was 7,000 words. So Wildbow's literally writing twice as much as he was a year ago.
Well, they're heavy on word count and heavy on plot important motions. Let's dive into them. First up is one after another 10.4 from Verona's perspective. We're finally back with Verona, who is hanging out with Tash by the beach.
Oh, it's finally time.
Yeah, it was good to see that header image, huh? We're back with Verona. And obviously we've been kind of waiting for this entire arc to get a chance to be back with Verona's head. And yeah, this chapter really delivers on all that hype.
Yeah, like I was kind of nervous coming into it, because in my head I was like, well, this has to be a big one. It's been over an arc since we've been in Verona's head. Like, it's going to have to be huge. And it was, as we said, both in word count and like content. Like, I think that's the thing. Wildbow's writing like twice as many words, but there's also like three times as much going on in those words. I know we often call this out, but I really want to do it for this one as well. These first like opening paragraphs are so important for kind of getting us back in a character's headspace. And I feel like that was more important with this one than ever before, because it's been over an arc since we were in Verona's head. So it's sort of like Wildbow needs to immediately put us back in the Verona headspace, and we haven't been in it for over a month. And it sort of opens with, oh, I'm so stressed, I'm getting headaches, I hate my stupid human body, and also I'm painting. And I just love, like, it's just such a great way to just, I was just immediately like, oh, yep, okay.
It's just all the classic Verona beats, isn't it?
Obviously also, like, you get that, like, the fact that she's got the headache thing, like, that's instantly, like, alarm bells. Like, you're like, okay, I'm a bit stressed. But then also she's doing art on the beach with Dash, so it's like, okay, it's not all bad. Like, It puts you in the headspace. It sets you with this little bit of tension, but also, you know, it's not doom and gloom. It's such a great opening.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Gets us right back into it. So one of the things that Verona mentions that I think is something that I'm intrigued to talk about more over the course of this chapter, she talks about her mum, obviously, because she's staying with her mum. And I feel like this is the... you know, we obviously have interacted with Verona's mum a bit, and we've heard all about her, all true things, I'm sure, from Verona's dad. But, you know, this really is the first time we've had a proper chance to get to know her a bit. And Verona talks about her and talks about this thing that she does where seemingly almost all the time she is, like, hosting and meeting and greeting people and kind of just, like, talking to them about their specialty subjects, I guess, was the vibe I got. And I think we had heard about, like, Verona's mum's dinners before, and in the back of my head I was just kind of like, oh, Verona doesn't get it, but it's probably, like, some swinging or something, like, Verona's mum is just kind of like that. That was, like, the assumption I had made. Because, like, I don't have any other, you know, more likely explanations. But, no, she legitimately just kind of has specialty subject dinners, and it's so – I don't understand it. It's so much stranger than what I thought it would be, and it makes me think that, again, legitimately Verona's mum might be in the practice somehow.
I like how it's easier for you to just assume that she does swinger parties.
Because that's like an explanation, right? Like the explanation we get from Verona, as expecting Verona said, oh, you know, I sat in on this dinner that she had with these two finance people. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And what was it? Verona's like, oh, they were just talking about finance. And I'm like, oh, that's so unexciting. How could that genuinely be the reveal?
I just kind of take it as a thing, because I guess my thesis for this chapter is, like, I feel like I finally get Verona's mom, in part because I think I'm very similar to Verona's mom in a lot of ways. For this, it almost feels like, I want to say Verona's mom, she doesn't do, like, people or emotions is kind of the vibe I get. Like, the reason it's always these dinners and it's, like, the professional talk is because I think that's what she excels at, and that's how she connects with people. But she's not someone who excels at being, like, emotionally close to people.
Mm.
Like, I bet you for all these people she's probably very good friends with and meets up with regularly to talk about this stuff, I wouldn't be surprised to learn that for most of them she's not a shoulder to cry on. Like, she's not.
Mm.
She's not a friend they go to when they need, like, emotional support.
But what is the... Do you have any relationships like this in your life, Elliot, where you're somebody that you know will travel around from town to town, have dinner with you every once in a while, and just kind of quiz you about, you know, virtual reality game development, for example? Like,
I 100% do, actually. It's a mutual friend who I'm not going to put on blast in this podcast.
A mutual friend with me.
Yeah, hold on. I'm just going to DM you this quick.
I think I can guess who it is now that you mentioned that this person exists. Yeah, that's who I was thinking. Interesting. Yeah, yeah, I guess
not,
with that
not to the same extent or anything, yeah. But like that's very much the sort of relationship I have with this person.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It just seems kind of wild to me. This is the biggest development in these two chapters to me, and I just can't get past it.
I don't know. Like, see, the thing for me is I found Verona's mum and her whole situation in this chapter. I can, in a very depressingly easy way, I could see myself falling into the exact traps Verona's mum has with parenting. Mm. In a way that really scares me. And it's just like, I mean, as well, I think something that you wouldn't want to mention to Verona because the idea has been poisoned by her dad. But Verona's mum says it at the end of the chapter. I think, like, Verona is similar to her mum in, like, a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah, they're very similar, huh?
Like, it doesn't manifest exactly the same, but, like, yeah, Verona has this similar sort of, I think she connects with people. Well, she hates the general concept of people. She said that multiple times, but she loves, you know, connecting with people who are weird or have an eccentricity and sort of helping them support that and all that. Like, it's a similar-ish vibe.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's definitely a similar vibe. Like, I think the thing that this chapter is really doing in a lot of ways is taking this thought that we have about Verona's mum of, like, oh, she's a bad parent and she's failed in these ways, and really holding a mirror up to Verona and saying, hey, this character that you've grown to love almost certainly would fail in the exact same ways that her mother has in those situations. I think that's just a really interesting kind of thing that this chapter is doing.
Yeah, like at the very least, this chapter really humanized Verona's mum to me, whether to the point where I sort of came away with this being like, yeah, like she obviously fucked up. Like, I'm not saying, shit happens. Like, I'm not saying that, but like, you know, Verona's mum is like at this point where she acknowledges it, and I can see how I would fall into the same trap that she did. And it's like, oh, like, you fucked up, but I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the most damning part of her failure is that it has left Verona with Brett, right? Like,
well, yeah, exactly.
That's really the worst part of it. So, yeah, interesting. And other interesting points, obviously, Verona has a bunch of interactions with Tash at this first part of this chapter, which is great. Yeah. They're obviously such a great team.
And, like Tashlet, like, the way we're using her to, like, emote to things, like the communication stuff going on here, that's another great part to the opening of this chapter. Like, Tashlet reacting to the emails Verona's getting from Lucy and stuff is just hilarious.
Yeah, for sure. I find Verona and Tasha's relationship really interesting because it feels like Verona is able to confide in Tash in a way that she just isn't with Lucy or Avery. Like, Verona is vulnerable with Tash in a way that she refuses to be with Lucy and Avery. And I think that's very fascinating as a dynamic.
Yeah. Well, because again, speaking of people who are similar to Verona, I think Tashlet is a lot more similar to Verona than I realized. Something sort of clicked in this chapter. Like, obviously we know that they get along.
Mm.
But, like, Tashlet in this segment is basically the voice of, hey, why not just communicate what you're feeling? Like, tell me you need support. Tell your mum that you're confused about how she feels about stuff. Like, Tashlet's MO in this whole bit is basically just telling her, hey, just communicate. It'll make things easier. And at first you just sort of like, oh, that has extra weight coming from Tashlet because she has difficulties with communicating. So she's like advocating for you to use what you have. But there's a part later in the chapter where every time Verona sort of says, oh, Tashlet, do you need anything? Do you need any help? Like, are you okay that your fingernails are falling off and you have to keep them to hold on to your humanity? And Tashlet's like, ah, yeah, don't worry about it. And it's like, we saw in her head in 9.Z, she was fucking ecstatic to have a human body again. Like, this shit eats at her way more. Like, she's a big hypocrite. Like, she's telling Verona all this stuff and then just, like, kind of falling into the same traps herself.
Interesting.
Part of me's a little worried about Tashlet.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I wonder whether there's a way that they can help each other mutually. Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think. I've kind of been looking for excuses to support a familiar bond between Tash and Verona. And I'm trying to think of, obviously Tash is great for Verona. I'm trying to think of more justifications for why Verona is so good for Tash that allow me to be fully on board with that ship.
I mean, the obvious one to me would be that it feels like Tashlet doesn't want this transformation into whatever she's becoming. And becoming a familiar lets her have an animal form.
It lets her
potentially stave that off in other ways for at least as long as Verona's alive, which could be anywhere between 2 weeks to, 70 years. I don't know. I'm trying not to get trigger happy on like familiar shipping people anymore.
Especially because even the very act of having a familiar is inherently seedy. You know what I mean?
It's a bond for life. Like, it's just, it's actually, in a way, it's almost worse than like shipping two people romantically because there's no divorce from familiar ship as far as we know.
Yeah.
I can see that. Part of me is just sort of like Verona had this thing. She finally fell apart. And that was when Tashlet it finally clicked for Tashlet that, oh, I need to really put my foot down and support Verona. And I'm just worried that something like that is going to have to happen with Tashlet for Verona to properly reciprocate. Cause at the moment she's fine just to be like, oh, do you need anything? And then when she says no, she's like, oh, okay. Just let me know. And I just get the vibe that Tashlet is not the sort of person who will actually let her know. One final thing from this little section as well, we talked about like the text messages and the like emails and stuff going on. This always jumped out to me when I was reading somebody else's live read. Verona sort of talks about how, oh, she got like a $50 phone bill in the first couple of days and stuff. It's like, because remember that was like a thing in 9.9, her dad told her he was going to cancel her phone, so clearly she got this new phone plan from her mum. And not only is that just a nice little detail, but the fact that she's on like prepaid plans just really sells that idea that this is such a temporary thing, but it's like at the same time she's escaped Brett.
Yeah, she's getting outside of his sphere of control.
Yeah. So it's not a great, it's such a great example of this whole section of the chapter because it's not a great fit. It's a shitty phone plan, but it's not Brett's, and that's what really matters.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Verona heads back to the house for a scheduled meeting. Her mother steps outside and Verona talks to David, her caseworker.
Yeah, and like heading back to this villa and like meeting Verona's mom, it's such a contrast to like the beach with Tashlet, because like Verona was like on black sand, which, as we all know, for Verona is like edgy and cool. And, like, with Tashlet, she felt like she could talk about anything. we get to her mom. Her mom and her have these awkward fucking exchanges about looking at drawings and like,
yeah,
this stuff. Like the room is white. Like Verona very specifically points that out, which is just Verona code for I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like these two just compared to Tash and her, who are so close. Verona and her mom at this stage are just oil and water.
Yeah. Verona calls this out where over the course of them hanging out, they always seem to not mesh well towards the start, and they finally begin to you know, gel as the trip comes to an end. And we really feel that. Like, it feels awkward, so awkward here.
Yeah. It was painful at times.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, as we'll see at the end, things get better.
Yeah. Should we talk about this, you know, chat between Verona and David? It goes okay, right? Like, I feel like it goes pretty well. I think the real beat to hit here is Verona's perspectives on this feel pretty warped. Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. And it feels obviously very natural for her, given that she's come from a kind of messed up family situation. But she's like defensive at weird times, but very open about things that I wouldn't have expected. And it's just kind of like she reacts in just kind of slightly off-putting ways to a few things. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it reminded me of like an important job interview or something. It's like when there's a conversation or a meeting or something that has a lot of weight behind it, I feel like it's just so easy to get in your own head like this. And like Verona, she's hyper-analyzing minute reactions to things she says. She's constantly, like, after she says something, thinking, oh, fuck, I phrased that all wrong. Like, yeah, this just put me in the headspace of, like, very important job interviews I was doing, like, straight out of college and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
And like, there's so many constant reminders of, like, Verona's, like, headache and, like, all those sort of stress, these physical stress manifestations that she has. And I don't know, I just really like that as, like, it helped me really feel the tension of this conversation from her and very viscerally. That it's, like, in between her freaking out and swearing in her own head, it's, like, also that she's got this, like, throbbing pain in her head.
Yeah. You do really feel it, don't you? She's just kind of setting up this idea of like, I mean, you know, the classic Verona bottling up, the bottle's kind of filling up and starting to slightly overflow. And then luckily it calms down over the course of this chapter, I think.
Yeah. Well, the other big thing as well is like when it's this important conversation, this really important moment, it can feel like your words are failing you, like all the pressure gets in your own head and you just feel like you're not speaking well, which is like, you know, obviously like makes it, it's like a vicious cycle of adding to the stress and then making you more panicked, which makes you less able to be coherent. As you said, like you were saying though, I think overall it seems to go pretty well. I think a lot of it is in her head. Like David, I don't know that he gets it, but I think he kind of gets it. Like a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. It's good. He does well.
Yeah, I love how he opens like the whole thing by just sort of being very upfront with her. He's like, these are the people I've talked to. This is sort of what I'm thinking. This is why I'm doing X. Why? Like, it's so not patronizing. It's so like upfront. He just kind of approaches her and like tells her exactly everything super clearly. He just got a lot of instant respect from me for that. And then, like, he opens up this drawing app, which, I mean, that might just be standard. We don't know, but at least he's smart enough to open with sort of saying, oh, this might work for you. So, like, he's at least put in enough homework to know it's good for Verona. So even if it is the default and they do it with everyone, the fact that he sort of knew that and, like, gave it to her, I was like, okay, I like this guy. This is going well.
Yeah, definitely. One thing that I think doesn't go well is Verona is unable to articulate why Brett is shit. And it's like, it feels like this kind of systemic shittiness that just needs so much context to understand. And that's evidenced by the fact that we as readers, you and I, and you know, a large proportion of the audience, didn't necessarily feel how bad Brett was until we had seen a number of these interactions. and it sucks, and I don't think there's a solution to it, and Verona does her best, but it just kind of feels impossible to really articulate Brett's shittiness here.
I really like that comparison to us as readers, because you're right, like, there were definitely stages where it was like, oh, he's such a bad dad, like, what a dick, and then it just sort of keeps going, and you're like, oh, he's awful, he's abusive, like, it took a while for it to ramp up for us, and yeah, like, you can see, like, David keeps trying to frame things around incidents. You can tell that, like, from a bureaucratic paper pusher standpoint, what he needs is, like, the big incidents. And it's like, but that's not how Brett works so much. Like, the big incidents aren't that big. It's just within the context of all the little ones, they weigh on you so much heavier. If you look at just the bigger incidents, they don't look that bad.
Yeah. It's annoying how Verona will say something, and clearly as soon as she said it, she realizes, like, this sounds so insignificant, but it was significant, and we know it was, but it doesn't kind of come across.
Yeah, like, smashing her art stuff, like, it's not painting him as a good father, but it just doesn't capture the oppressive environment that the house is.
Yeah, we're like, well, you know, sometimes I go to bed late because of all the chores. Which just sounds so, like, nothing, but it's a representation of the shittiness.
Yeah, like, so before vital. This story, and honestly, probably even after it, like, you know, the average 13-year-old coming up to me and being like, I have too many chores, I'm going to be like, all right, bud.
Yeah.
Like, don't we all?
Yeah, exactly. Talk to me when you're an adult. Although, I don't know what to make of this. There's another moment of... Verona mentions that she almost died, and David asks about it, and Verona says, oh, I don't want to get into it, blah, 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 blah. And then David just kind of lets it drop. That feels like you shouldn't just let that drop to me, right? Like, I don't know. I feel like if I heard that, that's just such a red flag. I don't know.
I mean, she pretty quickly establishes that it was like when she was away. And she says she doesn't want to talk about it, so I don't know, it's sort of like, she sort of like says it's not relevant to the case, and also like it's fine and sounds like she's dealt with it.
Yeah, I guess what can he do? Like, he can't force her to talk about something she doesn't want to, but even so, it's like,
yeah,
it just feels, I don't know, just, I mean, feels more important.
Hopefully he wrote it down, but I imagine he's probably picturing something like she went to a summer camp and her kayak capsized and,
yeah,
like,
true.
You know, she almost drowned or whatever, which is like, you know, not great. But
not like surviving multiple attempted murders.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't think, I think when we know too much about what she means was, yeah, he's just probably picturing like, oh, you know, I fell off the rope bridge that was a meter high at summer camp.
Yeah, fair. I guess if a kid says they almost died, normally it's, I don't know. It's probably, I mean, like, not.
Kids almost die a lot. Like,
yeah.
Like, yeah, not to dismiss that, but, like, you know, it happens. The last part of this whole talk with, like, David as well is when, like, Verona's mum comes in and kind of they do a bit together, and you just get this crushing moment where Verona finally suggests what everyone's been begging for, which is, can't she just go move in with Jazz? Like, just redirect the child support money to Jazz, please. And then we even get this line where Verona says to her mom, can't you just move to Kennet? If money's the problem, I can find a way to help you out. I can tell you stuff, which, like, stuff means,
oh yeah,
like awakening her mom, which is just like, God, I get it, but God, no, don't do that.
You don't need to, Verona, because she's already awakened. We all know it. It's going to be revealed.
I think it's such a good line to sort of reinforce how the parents or the adults here just will never quite get it. Like, you're bringing the magic in as a metaphor for that is perfect, because all Verona gets to say to her mum is, I can tell you
stuff. I can tell you stuff. God knows what.
Is nothing.
That, yeah. What would she even think that means? Who knows?
Exactly. Like, best case scenario, if you give that weight, it means Verona's dealing drugs or something. So it's like, yeah, it's just such a great one to sort of like bring the magic in to remind us that it's just like they're not going to quite comprehend how big a lot of this stuff is. And yeah, like this whole section with Verona, I feel like it was the most most vulnerable we've seen her in that sense of like being a young child who just needs support, like that kind of vulnerability of like a young child who needs help.
Mm.
Like I'm just thinking all those times, like even when she was being dragged off to like hell by the brownies, she found this sort of smug confidence to like put on a theatrical performance and yeah. sell them on letting her go for 12 hours. Like this is a girl who no matter what life threw at her, always was kind of able to find at least a way to put on, confidence. Like, you know, and again, with the questioning with Ray, it was like her breakdown came across as her laughing like Marisica. Like, this is the time where it feels like she just broke down. She's like, "Mom, please help me." Like, she actually felt like a child.
Yeah.
And it's kind of good to see that, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if it's because she's talking to her mother and that kind of, you know, inherently triggers a different side of her, right? Mm. The, oh, I need to be mothered side. Or whether it's because she just feels when it's practice things, regardless of how bad it is, she feels like there's more of a solution that she can tackle versus this life stuff, which she clearly, you know, it is less confident at being able to handle.
Yeah, I think it's like all of the above, probably.
Mm. Yeah, true.
last little thing from this section. Verona's mom still goes by Mrs. Haywood.
Mm.
Or at least that's what David calls her. And she doesn't correct him.
Yeah.
That's weird, right?
Mm, it's strange.
Because like, we called out Brett for still calling her his wife.
Yes.
So it feels only fair that we kind of call out the fact that she does actually still seem to go by Mrs. Haywood. And because we don't know too much about her job, but it's sort of in IT and stuff. So it didn't strike me as the kind of profession where it's like you keep a name for professional reasons. Like, you know, like actors or actresses will often keep their maiden name or like sometimes keep a married name because like that's if they found their fame with that name. It's just sort of easier from a brand standpoint to keep it. And I think academics do that too. But I don't know. I didn't get the vibe that that's what Verona's mum. I didn't get the vibe she's in that sort of industry. So
no.
I just,
yeah. Yeah, you're right. It is odd. It's kind of been something that we've seen with Brett a lot, obviously, where he's just kind of stuck in this rut. And so it kind of makes sense for him. But she feels less like that. So I wonder what the... I wonder if that's trying to say something similar or if there's another explanation that we might get in the future.
Yeah. Is she just too lazy? It's just too much effort to stop going by it.
I'm sure there could be some positive reasons. Like maybe it's a way that she feels she can kind of still connect to Verona a bit or I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, we might find out later.
I don't know how the paperwork for all this stuff works, but maybe it's like a, you know, if it's like, 2 days worth of paperwork to change your name back on all the tax forms and all that. Verona's mom strikes me as the person to just be like,
yeah, who gives a shit? Noise. Yeah, just a name. Fair enough.
Yeah. And speaking of, we still don't know Verona's mom's name, right?
No, we don't.
She's the last holdout after we weren't Brett's in arc 7, I think it was.
Mm.
I don't know. I feel like maybe we'll get it soon because she's actually fucking showed up finally.
Mm.
She's like, she's earned getting a name.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. More than Brett, for sure. But anyway, yeah, so Verona goes outside while her mum and David speak. But, of course, she uses magic to overhear them discussing what to do. And then her mother calls Brett and Jasmine to make plans.
I mean, as if you wouldn't use a rune here. Like, I was so glad Verona is the type to do this because I absolutely would have in her position.
Mm. Yeah. Props to Verona's mum here, though, right? Like, again, we aren't absolving her of all guilt here, but she really pushes for what Verona wants as her first priority and then kind of just goes and makes it happen, at least temporarily. Like,
yeah,
I was kind of expecting, I guess my standards for Verona's parents were pretty low because I was expecting Verona's mother to just, like, trivialize what Verona wanted and kind of steamroll her a bit more, and she just kind of doesn't. It's sweet.
Yeah, I was almost expecting the opposite. I was expecting just her kind of to roll over at the first sign of interference.
Mm.
Like, she would have been like, oh, Verona wants to go with Jazz. And say, that's not really an option. Oh, dang. But, like, yeah, like, I feel like this is sort of where Verona's mom started to click for for me, because it's like she's been awkward and distant and everything, but she still is driven by this core thing here in this conversation of, I want to do what Verona wants. Like, and it's sort of like you could see when she's present, she's actually a pretty good mum. Like, once the awkwardness is gone,
Yeah,
it's just she's that sort of person who gets caught up in the rest of it and maybe doesn't know how to prioritize as well as she should, and you know, ends up in this situation where it is awkward and she is distant.
Yeah. She does pretty well. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. It's you know, if the story started now and we never learned anything about what Verona's mom was like in the past, but just knew, you know, which effectively is kind of true, just knew the rough outline, she pretty much does exactly what it goes basically as well as it could here, right? Like, clearly Verona and her mother don't have a relationship where she will want to live with her. That's obviously true. But Verona's going to go live with Jasmine for, you know, a few months. Verona's mum will be around more.
I think it's just a few weeks. It's until the end of the story, so who cares?
Yeah, but, you know, Verona's mum will be around more, visiting more, building more of a connection, bonding more permanently, hopefully. Mm. And then, obviously, the end state of that will be that they're bonded more, and Verona going with her mum might be something that she actually wants. Like, it seems like it's about as good a solution as could be possible from all the stuff that we've been discussing. And, you know, as someone who reads and has read a lot of Wild Bo's stories, that doesn't happen that much, and it's just nice.
Yeah, I agree. Like, this went so much better than I expected. Like, we get the full list in a little bit of, like, all the stuff that's happening, but it's like, Brett's going to therapy, which is at least good, because hopefully the therapist will be able to vouch for what a piece of shit he is. Her mom is going to have these visits forced on her, which again just feels like that's how it needs to work for Verona's mom. Like, having compulsory video chats with Verona just feels like it's going... I'm optimistic that it's going to stop them drifting apart again.
Yeah, it's the kind of structure that they both need to, like, force them to do... to be a family, I guess.
Yeah. Because obviously, I mean, you know, it goes without saying, Verona's not the sort of person who is great at connecting with her mom either. As the daughter, it's not really her responsibility to put that effort in. But, like... You're right. It's something that will benefit the both of them.
Yeah, definitely.
And I love how this segment ends on, like, Verona goes back to the drawing app. And again, like, we always talk about how perfect the magic is in this world for, like, symbolism and, you know, like, all that sort of literary stuff. But I love how Wildbo doesn't leave it to just the magic. Like, you know, she goes in, it's like, after this great chat with her mom, like, helping David, she, like, draws more detail on her mum in the drawing and all that. Like, there's, like, you know, little details of that where it's like her mum did a solid, you know, she gets more detail in the drawing. I love that little detail.
Yeah, it's nice.
Like, we don't just leave that to the magic. And then, of course, like, yeah, the final lines for this whole segment are, like, David notices her drawing and sort of says, oh, why is your dad yelling at the cat? And then Verona's like, I'm the cat. He's like, why? And she's like, why wouldn't I be a cat? And that was, like, the moment for me where I was like, oh, okay, Verona's back. Like, this has gone well enough that we've got our Verona back.
We've got classic Verona, yeah.
And there is a little moment. Sorry, I forgot to mention it earlier. Verona's mum does sort of come out and sort of comment on her haircut, and that's the moment where it felt like, okay, Verona and her mum can have something now. The haircut was one of the first things we learned about Verona in 1.1. I don't remember why this detail is stuck in my head, but it's like 1.1. One of the first things we learn is that Verona's had this haircut for months, and she got it with her mum, and she just likes things to stay the same. So she's kept it. And her mum coming up and finally talking to her about something like that and kind of nailing why Verona has kept it. It was just like, yeah, that was like a moment where I was like, oh, there's hope for these two.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So yeah, Verona says goodbye for now to Tash and then goes to pay brief tribute to the local spirits as thanks.
Yeah, it's a fun little montage of the local others. Because, of course, Verona has made friends here with the others.
Yeah, yeah. She's just kind of making friends everywhere. We get some more sweet Tash and Verona interactions. They're very adorable together, and I ship them as familiar practitioner, even though that's a bit weird. You know, whatever. get on board. I mean,
they're definitely, I hope they find ways to help each other moving forward.
Yeah.
Like, as I said, I'm worried for Tashlit now. I hope we get our chance to help Tashlit.
Yeah.
But I also there's a handful of moments in this chapter where, like, Verona's suddenly a bit more eco-conscious. Like, she's avoiding plastics and stuff.
Mm.
And that's clearly her nature spirit friend.
Yeah.
Having an effect on her. That's a little detail I like.
Yeah, I thought that was good too. I don't know if it's an impression or just, Verona showing deference to the local spirits, but regardless, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Verona and VM head back to Kennet, and Verona pays kind of small tributes as they go. At a motel, Verona and her mother chat before Verona is interrupted by a spooky other.
Ooh. I love this detail of just how inconvenient travel seems now.
When you can't just run along a path.
Or just like their car breaks down in every region.
Yes.
Who has like a lord that wants to chat. Like, God, that'd suck.
Yeah. Being a practitioner, you're just more aware to the world around you, I guess, and the world is more aware of you.
This is why towns build a bypass. I get it now.
Mm-hmm.
Because the practitioners don't have to deal with this bullshit.
Yeah, God. We've been talking about how Verona and her mum feel so similar, and this conversation in the motel really is what puts the pin in that thought. I don't think I'd ever really considered why Verona's mum was so against kind of being in Kennet. Like, it feels like a weird hill to die on. But we get a picture of it, and it's effectively identical to what Verona was thinking about before she awakened, right? Like,
yeah.
Verona felt very stifled by Kennet, and if magic hadn't kind of expanded her world in so many ways, 100% she would move away from Kennet. She would never want to come back. Like, you know, she... They're so identical. And, you know, having a child means you have to kind of have an additional level of responsibility and selflessness that clearly Verona's mum has failed here. But, you know, again, they're just so similar.
Yeah, they're not quite identical, but they have a lot of shared traits, or very similar traits.
Yeah.
Which is just, I feel weird saying that because Brett has been telling us that in such a toxic way for this whole story, but it's actually kind of true.
Mm.
Just not in the way he meant it.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. What a twist. Brett was right about something.
But for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
I really like how Verona's mom starts to own up to her mistakes here a bit. Like, the sort of, I fucked up, but like, here's why. And, you know, like, hopefully we can go better from here. And it's such a nice moment, like the bit where Verona wants to show her drawings, which is like a beat that was set up earlier in the chapter, and really helps sell the idea of, okay, we're making progress.
Mm.
It's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, completely opposite vibes to the villa at the start of the chapter. Where they just 100%. Felt like oil and water. Here they're, like, on the same page.
You can feel that they actually genuinely have a strong connection and could be very close.
Yeah.
The end of this segment is basically the most ominous sentence ever. It's a figure stepped out of the darkness, and it wasn't the local others come to check in with her or welcome her to the area. And it's so ominous, and I was like waiting this entire chapter, things had felt like they were about to go wrong, and then suddenly they don't. And I was like, okay, like, you know, this is where it starts to go wrong. Oh, Verona's back. Yeah, sure. In the next segment. But actually it's like some other pretending to be Verona or something horrifying. But then again, Wabo pulls the rug out from under me and makes it nice.
Yeah. Ending this segment with this line, like, it's such a great, like, you're like, oh shit. And you're just scouring the next part being like, what's happening? What's going on?
Mm.
It's a great little hype teaser.
Mm. Yeah, it's great. Then we get the final segment. Verona has returned to Kennet with an old friend in tow, and the trio plan their next moves.
Yeah, but who cares about that other shit? Because Jasmine got the job.
Whoa! That's all. Yes, congratulations, Jasmine. We're all very proud of you. As if the Miss reveal wasn't enough, we also get the reveal that Rook is and always has been on the trio's side, which is so great. It makes it's again, it's a reveal that's just like, of course, it makes perfect sense. Like, there were so many times where Rook slipped clues to Lucy by manipulating what the earring could have heard, and we were like, oh, Rook's just fucking with things. Like, oh my god, you know, what's her game? But actually, the game was just being helpful by giving bonus clues. And I was like, it just makes so much sense. It's perfect.
Well, it's like, because I have to admit, there were times where I just started to feel like it was a little crazy how stubborn Rook was being about the Kenneteers not being okay. Like, there were just these moments I kept being like, Rook seems so smart, but like, holy shit, the Kenneteers are such a massive blind spot. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, and I was writing it off as like, oh, she's an other, so maybe this is just like, you know, a sort of cognitive difference she has where she can't physically look past this or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, we had moments like this, I remember, in Deep Impact as well, where I kept being like, something like, this doesn't quite make sense to me. It's a bit odd. And then later on, it would be because it was a twist. And
trust your instincts.
Yeah, it actually did make sense. Like, I don't think I was quite there with this one, but there just definitely been moments where I was like, it's weird that she's this dumb about this. So of course, the answer is she wasn't.
Mm. Yeah, it's great. It's such a good reveal. I loved it.
I especially love, like, I'm just already so on board with the vibe of Rook and Miss. Like, I hope we get to see a lot of them together. Like, the little detail of how Rook holds one of her masks in front of Miss's face and just perfectly keeps it in sync with Miss's movements is, like, not only a sign of how in sync they are, but it's such a, like, intimate and, like, you know, kind of unnecessary gesture. Like, Miss doesn't need her face to be covered, but I assume it's probably easier for her if the universe isn't having to conspire ways to hide her face.
Yeah. So it's less just of like, a drain on her power or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So like it probably does sort of help. Yeah, it's just nice. And there's this great, like, I think the scene that sells their friendship as something that will be fun is like the moment where Miss gets cranky at Rook for how she's been helping. And Rook's just like, hey, you know, you ask a wacky old me to help. You gotta know what you're getting into. Yeah, they just seem very fun.
Mm. Yeah, they're good friends, huh? Now, another thing worth touching on, the Montague thing. So Montague poses enough of a threat to Miss that she can't come back inside Kennet. The question is, I think, is this intentional on whoever's setting up Montague's part or on Montague's part themselves? I don't think Montague's a co-conspirator. He seems a bit too chill. But, you know, Montague was sponsored by Edith and Alpi, so the fact that Edith was a sponsor is obviously a bit sus, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's implied by both Miss here and Marisica later that they did this with Monty deliberately. Like, they know that he'll keep Miss out.
Yeah.
That was a perk of him, but I agree with you. I don't get the vibe that Monty is in on it.
Yeah,
he's probably an unwitting, like, yeah, he just doesn't realize this is another effect he has.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But yeah, that's the end of 10-4. So should we move on to 10-Z?
Yeah. Oh, one last thing, fun little callback to remember in 10.1 where Avery tried to call Miss from the paths, but Miss didn't answer.
Mm.
I guess it's because she was already sitting outside Kennet.
Makes sense. Like,
I'm just imagining Miss sit camped outside Kennet waiting for one of the Kenneteers to emerge so that she can talk to them. And being then she, like, she feels this tug on her connections from the paths and it's like, are you fucking serious? Like, just got out of there.
Yeah, good times.
Anyway,
so yeah, 10.Z, we start in the perspective of Sydney, who is running from her parents, exploring the mean streets around her before deciding to burn out a car that she finds.
Yeah, and so obviously this is the first facet of the girl by candlelight that we will be meeting. And I love this as a perspective to wrap up arc 10. Like, one after another has, like, most prominently been an arc that was showing or giving us insight and showing us the consequences of how many different, like, sides to the conflict in this town there are.
Mm.
And so what better way to close out the arc that's talking about a town with all these different aspects and teams in it to going into the perspective of like the woman who has multiple facets and sides to herself. This chapter is such a great tangible way of closing out everything Arc 10 has been talking about. I was just in awe of it. Like, as soon as I clocked on what was happening, I was like, oh, that's fucking genius.
Yeah. Yeah, it's clever. Definitely.
And I feel like it bits of the Girl by Candlelight tie into every other interlude in the arc we've seen. Like Sydney, who we start with here, she has this sort of lack of control that as an echo that reminded me of Chloe at times. There's all these cycles of violence that aspects of her are born into, which, you know, touches on like John and Toadswallow stuff. Like, I won't go into all of them, but it just ties into everything the arc has been doing in such a cool way.
Yeah. It's a great thematic wrap up for sure. The thing I really loved about this first segment is how much the prose focuses on like lights and lighting. Obviously, because we're kind of presumably seeing this memory filtered through the mind of the GBC, but there's just so much like fire and light imagery that is so fun. You know, one of the first sentences is describing the hallway as lit. Like everything is described as either lit or unlit, and the color of the light is kind of bathing these scenes. It just gets us in the mindset of lights and fire very immediately. Like light and darkness is the theme that plays throughout this chapter for sure.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Well, and it's always like in this start of Sydney's one, it's always like orange and warm lights. And as you say, like something to take note of is it's always the lights are behind her, lighting the way in front, but she's running towards the shadows, which is just like, I mean, as we're going to learn, that's what Girl by Candlelight does.
Mm-hmm.
She is this light. She's always running face first into the darkness.
Yeah. So then we get the segment again repeated, but kind of more warped, right? Which is very interesting. And I think the purpose of it is kind of showing that this aspect of Sydney that we're following is I guess more of a pattern than a real person. And I'd kind of assumed that we were seeing Sydney fall into becoming an other, but later we find out that Sydney's kind of gone on and lived a life and kind of discarded the part of her that was Pyromania. So presumably that's what we're kind of following here, the repetition of Sydney's Pyromania transitioning into feeling like more other.
Well, yeah, it's like the echo and we kind of jump to it being more degraded.
Yes, yeah.
Like after the jump, it's like the rain is heavier, there's more of these ruins dwelling others. She has less of her stuff. It's like I feel like the opening part is sort of the echo forming. It's more pure incarnation, and then we jump to seeing it as it's been degraded and is starting to fray.
Starting to feel vulnerable as well, right?
Yeah.
Because you know, we get introduced to this like incessant darkness that's always lingering at the edges of. I wrote Edith here, but I think I'm going to mess up and use those names interchangeably, even though they're not quite interchangeable. Anyway,
100%.
You know, we get introduced to this darkness that is lingering in GBC's peripheral vision forever. And in the back of my mind, I had this conflicting thought of like, oh, this feels similar to the Doom, but that obviously timeline-wise doesn't quite make sense. And those thoughts are in conflict, but I hadn't really thought about it until obviously we get to the end of this chapter and we find out the Doom isn't what it seems. And so maybe the reason they feel similar is because the Doom is partially some of this stuff that Edith has fed it with.
Yeah, I agree. I get this feeling that like we see all throughout this chapter, the various incarnations of the Girl by Candlelight are all running from their own dark chasing things.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have to believe that some of that is being fed into Edith's Doom to make the Doom that we've seen. I 100% agree that like this, the fear of these ruins dwellers, the potential connection to the abyss that the lantern had, like all of these are feeding the Doom a little bit. Because especially if it's, you know, not just Edith. Wait, it would make sense that it's not just Edith's doom, but it's the girl by candlelight's doom, and that would be a doom with many faces.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just kind of this incessant amalgam of darkness that has been chasing Edith / GBC in different forms.
Yeah. When it helps draw that line from how this single first echo to the Edith and the girl by candlelight that we know today, like the concept of the doom, even if we do just take it as mostly or all Edith's doom that is in Matt, it's not a new thing for her. She's had something like this after her from day one.
Yeah, true. So yeah, we jump to the next segment and we see a man with a lantern abusing a woman, and the GBC watches before kind of starting to intervene and ending up helping the man and woman both fall to the abyss before GBC collects the lantern into her amalgam of spirits.
Yeah, so she takes it on as her third half.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. This abyss place continues to become more and more relevant to the story, it feels like. Here we learn the little detail that apparently they thought it was hell for a long time. So it's like, the more we learn about the abyss, the more I'm like, why do people go there? Why is that person drinking the abyss?
Maybe they're just thirsty, Elliot. Don't worry about it. He's so obsessed with it.
It's gross. I don't know. Because obviously there's a small part of Edith's lantern, or Girl by Candlelight's lantern, that is like connected to the abyss. It comes up later. So it's like, yeah, I mean, we saw what the Abyss Beast in Arc 9 was doing, like tearing holes that got closer to the abyss. Like, is that going to be something the Doom is capable of doing? Like, we've got these scars now in town from the Abyss Beast. Is that something the Doom can fuck with?
Yeah, I don't know. The Abyss still feels so unknowable in this story.
Yeah, it just keeps coming up, so I wonder if it's going to be involved in the end game, but I don't know enough about it to know how that would work.
We'll have to see, I suppose.
Also, shout out to Cole here, the abusive stepdad, because he has this one line where he says, "Either allow me to mold and alter the spirits that make you you, for which I'll require your consent, or fall." Now, the definition of consent here for Cole. What are you talking about, Cole? That's not like, yeah, this is such a ridiculous, like, I love how the girl by candlelight is sort of introduced here, and it's like, it's just immediately presented with this situation where it's like, okay, this guy's the fucking worst.
Yeah, he's pretty terrible, isn't he? Good to have some characters that make Edith look good in comparison.
Yeah, it's like, even in our, like, you know, quote-unquote bad guy interlude.
Yeah.
We still meet someone who's just like, oh, fuck this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. So this segment is interesting because, like, we've had a few segments from the perspective of others before, or from the perspective of kind of like social outcasts, right? We've had Chloe, we've had the Teds, and both of them have had moments of like, oh, we can relate to creatures that are like us and empathize with them. You know, we had fucking Dee Dee's in Toad Swallow's interlude, Dee Dee, you know, having this moment with this kid that was clearly her empathizing with and then taking action to save this child. And this segment feels like it's setting up to be the same thing where, oh, you know, Cole is harassing and abusing Bailey, but GBC is going to take stand and help Bailey get out of this situation. But that's not what happens. GBC does some minor intervention and Bailey and Cole both fall into the abyss. And it's just unexpected to me. I expected it to be a bit more empathy with GBC, but that's just not what it is. It shows to me, and maybe it's because we're still early on, but it still feels to me like we're getting from this. GBC is a character with her own goals. And while this chapter makes her sympathetic to us, she's not empathetic, and I think that's an important distinction to keep in mind.
Yeah, well, it takes us back again to that Metaphaos lesson in 8.1, where Metaphaos was like, yeah, you got these big gods, these big spirits that kind of show up naturally, and they can be missing things from the human experience. And like, yeah, here the girl by candlelight is still very much missing any concept of empathy, because I like... I was expecting her to at least want to absorb Bailey or something.
Yeah, for sure. But it's not that at all.
Like, she wants that shiny lantern. She's like a moth drawn to a flame. Yeah. She wants the lantern. And she doesn't give a shit about Bailey or Cole.
Like, yes, legitimately. Like, it's not that she... Like, I think I wouldn't have as much of a problem with it if with her letting Bailey fall if she at least, like, thought...
Oh, that's not good.
Like, oh, that's something that is sad, or oh, this is so upsetting, whatever, right? But it's not. There's just like, it's this like cold observation of the situation.
Yeah, and like Charles gives us a bit more insight into how she's progressed in that front later, but like, yeah, it seems like even at her best, as just the girl by candlelight without Edith, there were still gaps in her ability to do things like trust. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And something we'll get into more a bit later as well is, like, on top of this, she also has this ability to lean into certain parts of herself to exacerbate certain emotions or qualities, which is such a great... It's just a cool idea.
Yeah, definitely. It's, yeah, just the tangibility that we are left with, like... Each of Edith's parts feel so much more whole after this chapter. And I think that's very interesting as we obviously rapidly move towards a conflict with Edith. I am looking forward to seeing those components come out.
Yeah, and we've got, like, now all these insights into some of her abilities. So obviously we know she can, like, lean into these parts of herself to emit certain emotions or, like, present certain parts of herself. And we've seen parts of that in action when she was, like, coming into the ruins, and parts of her came in first. Like, she must be leaning into those parts to bring her, like, spirit as a whole into those places.
Yeah.
And, like, we'll get into it later, but I'm already, like, fucking in love with this, like, clairvoyant power she has where she touches the parts of people's bodies and she gets, like, echoes from them. Like, yeah. It's so cool because you're right. As we head into a conflict with her, we're getting an idea of how she works, how she thinks, what her powers are. Yeah, it's cool in every way.
Yes. I think it's especially cool that as the previous chapter ended with the trio planning to bind Edith, this segment that we come up to next is Edith bound and what that looks like, and specifically what it looks like when Matthew comes to her rescue, which is almost certainly something that we might expect when they conflict in the future, right?
Yeah, it could come up.
Yeah, so, Edith travels and you know, amalgamations catch up with her here as she is caught by practitioners but is rescued by a gallant knight who she quickly falls in love with.
As a quick aside, I just also want to call out the writing of this chapter for how, like, it feels like the prose changes in jumps like this. Like, as Edith... As the girl by candlelight becomes more defined or whatever, she, or as she leans on certain facets even, there's like subtle changes to the way things are described that just make you feel this way she can change her personality as she goes.
Yeah.
Like she does it here as she's trapped. She's like leaning into the more helpless parts of herself to like beg for help and admit stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's forget about that shit because we've got to talk about our fucking hero here, Matthew No Mercy Moss.
Oh, God. Like, realizing as I'm reading this that we're seeing this because it's pretty likely that the trio are going to have to fight Matthew soon, and seeing how fucking terrifying he is, I'm just like, this is horrible.
I mean, it was awful, but also, isn't it just cool as fuck?
Like, yes, he's great. He's so good.
Like, it was just... it took me back to some of those earliest days reading Parahumans and just seeing a cool new superpower for the first time. Like, seeing a Heartless or Host, I don't know which one he is at this point, like, in action. Was just... Yeah, he has that one line where he says, if it's any consolation... I'll feel bad about what I've done to you here when my conscience and sense of mercy grow back, which is just probably the most badass thing I've ever read.
Yeah. What a badass.
So yeah, horrifying, terrifying, but cool.
Mm-hmm. we already kind of knew the rough bits of this origin story, both for, you know, the GBC and for Matthew, but seeing it play out is obviously very interesting. And it still feels to me like GBC here is effectively what we see her like without Edith. And that's worrying in terms of this conflict again.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a bit more rounded out, I think, by the time, by like modern times.
True, by some of these Charles visits that we're going to see soon.
Yeah, oh, and presumably like that amount of time in Edith has just reshaped her a bit, even when she's out of Edith, to some extent. Like, you know, just like, God, I'm trying, yeah, like a bit of Play-Doh that, like, you know, maintains a bit of its old shape or something. I can't think of a good comparison right now. But yeah. I can't get over this power the Girl by Candlelight has, like, so where she touches the different, like, I can't remember what the actual word was from the extra material we read, but, like, you know, his chakras, and she sort of, like, gets echoes from each of them. Like, it's such a great, what a cool way for us to just get, like, massive insights on characters, because Girl by Candlelight can just touch various parts of them and get, like, instant reads on.
Get a read out,
What matters to them. It's just such a cool concept.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very cool. It's great. Oh, man, these chapters are so good.
They're just great. I want to reread this story after it finishes. And this is something I'm just going to have to look out for now. It's every single time Edith touched one of the Kenneteers, where did she touch them?
Yeah, what was the thing that she might have got from them there?
Yeah, exactly. Like, if she, you know, she touches their cheek or whatever to get near their mouth, like, you know, she'll see something important they recently said or something.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So cool. And again, like, we're obviously going to get to talk a lot about Matthew and Edith's relationship as the chapter moves forward, but something that sort of hit me as we're reading this part is, like, Edith is this character who's, like, a bunch of little jigsaw pieces that have, like, found each other and have, like, morphed themselves a bit to fit together. And I just love how that contrasts against Matt, who is like this person who is carving bits of himself out to like they're already this kind of perfect conceptual match for each other, where he's somebody who is digging bits out of himself to find better things to fill them, and she's looking for nice, like, holes to fill and fit in.
Yes, they're opposites specifically.
Yeah,
right. Which means they fit well together, but, you know.
Yeah. Something, I don't know if I'm tinfoiling here, but, like, the weakness the Girl by Candlelight finds in Matthew here is she notes that his stomach is sort of empty. He has, like, no ambition, no want for power. And she sort of thinks, oh, like, God, I need to get in there and fill that and, like, give him a sense of drive. And I almost wonder, like, we get some, you know, insights into how Matt feels about his dad and all the shit his dad did. And part of me almost thinks, do you think he emptied that part out of himself on purpose? Or like, was that like a punishment? Like, as a way to not be in, as a way for him not to get punished for what his dad did? Did he remove that part of himself as a kind of like, see, that won't be me? Like, I'm just going to be me?
Yeah. I wonder. I don't know if it's like overtly magical or just a inherent kind of rebellion, you know?
Yeah. There's nothing in the chapter to actually suggest that it's anything more than he was so emotionally fucked up by what went down with his dad that he has just turned into a person who doesn't have ambition. But part of me was also like, but what if he actually did it to himself? Like, I don't know.
I can't think
of a thematic reason to justify it, but it seems cool.
Maybe that's enough. So, yeah, we jump forward again, and GBC and Matt are visiting Charles, who is kind of GBC's therapist, helping her have more composure. Matthew steps outside, and GBC confesses her love to Charles.
Yeah, or her love of Matt.
Her love for Matthew to Charles, yes.
I love what you said. Like, Charles is just being like an other doctor here, like, slash therapist. But, like, it's actually cool because if my understanding of the timeline is right, this is Charles, like, post some of that Blue Heron stuff, even. Like, this is him, or it's probably around the same time as the the thing we saw in Alex's interlude, where it's like he's quit after that, like Revenant came back.
Mm.
And he's like, he's trying to be a better person. And it's so cool that his way of doing that is to like partially be working as a doctor for people like the girl by candlelight. That's just cool.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. It is cool. We see Matthew and Charles so much in this chapter, and they're just so great. And it just makes me sad that they're embroiled in the bullshit of Kennet, kind of against their, I mean, Matthew's against their knowledge. Charles's is, we don't know, but the suspicion is possibly against his will.
We'll yeah, say. Charles being a culprit has just never felt right to me.
Mm.
Which, you know, given my prediction track record, means he's got pretty decent odds of being involved, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just don't even see him, yeah, being involved as a stooge that much, which seems ridiculous because he so clearly seems like he is.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? Yeah, I guess we'll have to see. I don't know. I worry for poor Charles that he's just being taken advantage of by these horrible others.
Yeah, the only way I can see him being involved, in my opinion, is if he is being forced into it, which I suppose like is possible because since he's forsworn, it's like easy to torture him and not have like, any karmic backlash.
Yeah, so, I mean, GBC seemingly is kind of being pressured into it. There's no reason to not think that that's happening with others.
Yeah, so we'll see. But like, you're right. I just like how we see like Charles for a bit here, and we see a lot of Matt in this chapter, and both of them just come across as like good practitioners. Like, so we talked about so much in this goddamn story. It's like practitioner culture or whatever. And it's like Matthew and Charles really strike me in this chapter as like what you'd want them to be.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Like, you can see how they ended up in Kennet despite sort of being practitioners.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, they fit the ideal of what Kennet is trying to be very well, don't they?
Yeah.
Can we touch on this confession of love? Because again, like, it feels quite other to me. Like, GBC says she's in love with Matthew and describes it, but the description of it feels, I don't know, it's not completely off, but it's like this feeling of like wanting to possess his body. And it's not, I think it's close enough to kind of flowery language that I've heard other people use to describe love that is like, okay, I can see this as an interpretation of love, even though it's not the way I would describe my love for a partner, you know. But it just feels a bit slightly disconnected from that and a little bit still alien to me. And again, it's just like othering for GBC in my mind.
Yeah, well, like, one of the main words she uses to describe her own love for him is possessive, which is just not a word that's associated with healthy.
It's a word that feels, unhealthy, exactly.
I mean, I agree, though. I think, like, the majority of, like, the rest of her description of it, it kind of just feels like it's, like, a love, but through this lens of being a spirit. Like, I think the majority of the weirdness of it just comes from, because she's not a human, especially at this stage, like she, you know, like Charles brings up like sexual attraction or whatever. It's like she doesn't have that. Like, what she kind of is as a spirit, she possesses things and fills in gaps. And that's what she sees in Matt. And that's kind of, I think that's where this desire is born from. This idea, she saw somebody who has helped her and has a problem, has a hole in his, well, not his heart, but a hole in himself.
Mm-hmm.
And she would perfectly feel it, and it just like hurts her that she can't.
Mm.
So yeah, like the obviously it's not a super healthy thing because of where we are in 2020, but there's like a huge part of this that's not, just a bit different because it's spirity and not necessarily totally unhealthy.
Mm. Yeah, maybe that's an unfair assessment from me to like paint it with the brush that because it feels a bit alien to me that means it's bad, but.
Yeah,
I
mean, there's definitely a part that is bad because, well, yeah, she uses the word possessive and we see where they've ended up. So clearly it's not 100% healthy, but I think some of the weirdness is just, because she's not human.
Mm. Yeah. GBC wanders looking for Matthew. We're 2 or 3 years later, is that right?
Yeah, closer to 3, he says.
Yes, but Matthew finds her first. He takes her to a hospital, and she becomes Edith.
Yep, and Edith was indeed ethically sourced.
Yes, very nice to find out. Again, Matthew comes across looking pretty great. He 100% feels like he has been a victim of Edith's manipulations, and at every point he has tried to do what is right and good. He calls out their weird power dynamic. He just wants to help her, not like own her. Matthew, you're a hero. I always believed in you. Elliot, well played on your prediction game, because your prediction, you've been kind of championing that Matthew is effectively under Edith's thumb. And it's not, you know, exactly that, but it's effectively that. So I'll pay that. I think that deserves a thumbs up on the prediction scale.
I think in my head he was more like knowingly under her thumb, whereas it seems much more like he has no idea.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I really love this point you bring up, like, because about the relationship dynamic, because this is something we called out in like chapter 1.3. We were kind of like, it's a bit weird that this dude has gotten married to someone he effectively like raised and clarified.
Yes.
Like, and so it's so good to see that, like, actually Matt was aware of that and like wasn't really cool for it. Just nice to see that Matt has pretty much always been a pretty great person. Like, you know, sometimes he cuts his own mercy out and goes ham, but like when he's Matt, he's a cool dude.
Good work, Matthew. And then we jump to the present. Finally, Edith is attending a goblin funeral for her co-conspirator / blackmailer, I guess. Marissica comes bearing gifts, requests, and news. So before we get to any of these bombshells, we'll get to them in a moment. First off, the goblin funeral. Fucking delightful. I don't really have that much to say about it that isn't just saying, oh, it's so good.
Yeah, I was just tempted to highlight like every sentence and pull it out my live read. It was hilarious. It's a shame about Biscuit. I really liked her. But she's sad. Dead now.
So sad.
The pledges for Biscuit was hilarious. Like the bit where she's like, oh my God, can I die for real? That sounds awesome. like the whole vibe for this funeral is just so perfectly. It's like the goblin manifestation of being formal. Like it felt formal for goblins, but also very distinctly goblin.
Yeah. And some of it is genuinely heartwarming, right? Like, non-ironically, the goblins are like paying tribute to their fallen comrades in a way that feels very like trash Viking-esque, I guess I would say.
Yeah, well, as Matt points out, it's kind of surprising they're even doing that. Like, it really speaks to a lot of this stuff we've talked about for so long now with like goblin culture and this idea that, you know, we could do stuff like funerals, which I think probably don't happen very often for goblins. But still do it in a goblin-y way. It's kind of cool to see them growing. Especially, like, again, speaking of goblin culture change, my little boy Pekasnot tries to offer up some artwork here and gets denied. And then, like, Snowdrop sort of says, Snowdrop gives him the message of, like, hey, your drawings are actually great. Like, don't get down on them. And, like, Pekasnot has this really heartwarming moment because nobody disagrees with Snowdrop. And I was like, hell yeah, Snowdrop. Like, let's fix goblin culture one little snot boy at a time. The only one who doesn't really get what's happening is Cherry Pop, but what else is new?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what part of what makes it so delightful, I guess.
Yeah.
How
does Cherry Pop still not get it? It's just...
Don't question it. It's Cherry Pop. That's just how it works.
I know, but it's just every time I laugh at it, I'm also just like, how is this still, like, how is she this dumb? Like, I think it was like 1.4 when they went to John's house and Cherry Pop was like, oh, I'm so stupid. And I just remember thinking, oh, you know, she's probably being a bit harsh on herself, but she really wasn't. She's really fucking dumb.
No, she is dumb, but that's part of Cherry Pop's charm. So should we talk about...
Yeah.
Some of these bombshells. First off, Gilla may hide the witch hunter, and I kind of, you know, I called it, so I'll get the thumbs up on the prediction for that one.
Yeah.
But I don't know if my reason was, you know, the way that fight shook out, Gilla may felt like he was becoming closer to the Kennedys as their ally while Mariska was being set up as like the inhuman killer. And I don't know if that's exactly what the reasoning was, but that would kind of track to me.
Yeah, I mean, who fucking knows with the fairy? That could be like, that could be one of his 50 reasons.
Yes.
Is the thing, yeah. So yeah. No, I'd count it. I'd count it.
All right, thanks.
I mean, one little snippet we get here is Marisica sort of mentions that she knows who his contact is. It's a human that interacts with the courts.
Mm.
And I find that interesting because I'm assuming the way this is phrased, this is the same contact he was meeting with on the night of the Carmine Beast's murder.
Mm.
So this just feels like a character now who's going to have to be important at some stage. If that is the same person, like, yeah, like, is this someone from the Blue Heron Institute? Is it a practitioner? Like,
well, who's the Estrella? Most likely? Yeah, Estrella is the only, like, Estrella is the most fey interacting practitioner we've met, right?
Yeah, but she deals with the Winter Court, and that's not our boy yet. Or like, so she. Is he making some sort of deal with her before yeah, he falls to
she's getting
in
on the ground floor.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah. Like, but could be. I wonder what's in it for Guillaume. Like, what has he negotiated with her to get her?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, or, like, fuck, is it, like, Daniel? That'd be fucking, like, probably not Daniel, but, you know, like, is it someone, like, is it not a practitioner? Is it more someone like Shelley and Daniel?
Yeah, interesting. Maybe.
I just want, because if it's that, then maybe the only person who can stop them is Shelley and Daniel. Because I'll take any excuse to bring them in for the finale.
Yeah, actually, true. Now that it's revealed that Mariska's definitely on Team Baddie here, maybe this is our excuse to get Shelley and Daniel back in the story.
I think the last we saw of them, Avery implied it would just be a phone call, but I can dream.
Yeah, a phone call as a prelude to, hey, come help us kill this fae.
Yeah, you know what, actually, I don't have the minutes for this. You should just come.
So, second bombshell, Edith is... I wrote under Marisica's thumb. It's a little vague. I definitely feel like Marisica seems like the head honcho and Edith is kind of an enforcer type. Edith has been doing some unspecified things for Marisica, you know, some strings that were attached that were never explained, and Marisica is helping supply Edith with her doom juice.
See, it's interesting. I get what you mean. But I got the vibe that they're actually a bit more equal. Like, I wouldn't have used under Marisica's thumb.
Mm.
I do think, like, the girl by candlelight is probably way in over her head working with someone like Marcy.
Yes.
But I think as far as their interactions go, like, Marisica is about as upfront as Marisica can be for a lot of this.
Yes.
Like, she explains her reasoning to Edith on a bunch of things. She like tells her things like, oh yeah, there are, you know, there'll be other things, but I'm a fairy. Like it's like, I feel like Marisica was being as fair with Edith as you can kind of ever expect her to be.
Is that a fake out? Is that,
well, yeah, good point. Know. I mean, what's I'm not going to compete with the fairy or with Wild Bow on these mind games, but
yeah.
I don't know. I kind of get the vibe that, like, they at least are pretending like they're closer to equal parts.
Yeah.
I think Marisica probably had more of a hand in the scheming and probably, you know, would have the upper hand if when the dominoes finally fall in place or whatever, but at least they're presenting as if, like, Marisica is putting in her best to make it seem like they're fairly equal in this arrangement. They also, like, Marisica constantly says to Edith, like, when you take this bullet, you can't tell them about us.
Yeah.
Which, like, could just mean Liz and Sig.
Yeah.
But I kind of feel like their cat is already out of the bag.
Yeah, it feels like there's another conspirator.
Yeah. I read this as there being at least one other, like, head conspirator.
Yeah, haven't we gotten a confirmation before that there was like at least in some of these scenes a male and female figure, and we don't really have the male figure yet, right?
That was way back in 3.Z when they interviewed Yolda, I think it was.
Yeah,
and the thing is with Marcy and the cards, like, you know, she can appear as she fucking,
I guess,
wants.
Glamour's on the table now for sure, but like I'm still kind of on the Charles is also under Marcy's thumb train, I think.
Yeah, That's fair.
But we'll have to see, I suppose.
I can't think of who else it would be. So I keep kind of, I don't want it to be Charles, but I can't think of anyone else it could possibly be.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we basically it's confirmed that it's not Matthew now, right?
So yeah. It seems pretty unlikely. Just as an aside, can I say it's kind of hilarious? Like, I think we've really drawn attention to this since we found out Marissa Kerr is 100% definitely in on it. But the idea that, like, the hilariously over-the-top evil fairy is actually one of the main baddies is just hilarious too.
Wait. The fairy that turned into, like, a half-bat monster stuck in a spider's web is actually evil? No.
Well, it's just like, at the start of Arc 2, we meet the fairy, and it's just kind of like, these guys are manipulators, they're schemers, they're playing chess, you can't trust them.
Yeah.
Check out this Marissica one, she's clearly got, like,
she's evil nightmare vibes. She's got, like, evil wings, like, the kind of wings that only evil characters have.
Like, it's just, and then it's just like, one of the culprits was that fucking super evil fairy everyone warned you about in chapter one.
Wait, I should, before I get angry tweets, I should do a retraction. Those kind of evil wings, evil characters, or my really cool Sonic OC characters. Those are the only two types of characters that have these kinds of wings.
The hell are you talking about?
Never mind. moving on. Bombshell number three, not really a bombshell. Edith and Marcy know what Miss and the Kennedys are up to. We don't really know if they know about Rook. It doesn't seem like they do. This one isn't really a bombshell, but just kind of a escalation of conflict, I suppose.
Well, it feels like it's having the rug taken out from us a little bit because, like, Miss at the end of 10.4 felt like our secret weapon in a way. It's like, oh, sure, she can't come into town, but, like, you know, Miss was the fucking player of Kennet. Like, she was running it before she left. So it felt, even if she couldn't come back and retake her throne, it was like, okay, well, her being back changes things. And it was like an ace up the Kennedy's sleeve. And it's like, okay, well, maybe we still have Rook, but that's like one of our big aces up our sleeves taken out.
Yeah, for sure. And then we have the fourth bombshell, the Major Edith bombshell.
Sorry, before you do that, just how do you reckon Marissica knows the Miss is back is my question as well. What if Rook is...
Oh, a triple agent. Interesting. I like it.
Yeah, I thought that might be your speed.
Yeah, no, I like it. It's good. Confirmed. so then, obviously, the major bombshell in relation to Edith here is Edith has been intentionally feeding the Doom so that Matthew has a reason to stay with her, which is so horrifying and completely validates that Matthew has been a champion all along. It's rough.
Yeah, so it basically sounds like she used this to trap him into staying with her. Like her, this ambitious side of her, the one that wanted to, or the one that had desires and wanted to be with him, has turned her into the Alexander of Kennet, is what it feels like.
Mm. The Alexander of Kennet in the... She's also, you know, older, but totally dateable. What do you mean?
No, wait, just this drive for ambition is what's caused her to be toxic as fuck.
But it's not ambition. It's like, it feels like a kind of desperation of desperately trying to force this relationship to exist. I don't know if I would call it ambition so much as, I don't know.
I mean, it's not like a one-to-one mapping, but she frames it as like a desire thing.
Sure.
As we head into the climax, I'm going to be looking for more and more ways to sort of see what the Blue Heron fight was telling us about the final fight, because they'll obviously be thematically related in some way.
Yeah.
So this feels like one of the first connections I'm making is that, like, we're seeing another person who's kind of created a toxic setup because of an unhealthy level of, like, desire or ambition.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the end of these chapters. Some two really good chapters to move us into some intense showdowns.
Yeah, because you've already read 11.1, haven't you?
Yeah, and you won't believe what happens. I was going to make a fake spoiler, but I just couldn't be bothered. I don't know. Anyway, moving on. It's not the end of our show yet, Elliot. And why is that, you ask? Well, it's because we still have to talk about some predictions. as our own predictions were validated in this episode, we want to give other community members the chance to validate their own predictions. And I'm going to start with a prediction that I think is going to prove to be true from user Beleg Tal, who predicts Jeremy Clifford is clearly related to the big red carmine beast. And I just think that's, I mean, like, naysayers may say that that's nonsense and obviously incorrect and a joke and that I shouldn't have even brought it up. But I say, on the off chance that it's true, I want to make sure it's recorded for posterity so that Beleg Tal gets the brilliant credit that they deserve.
What's funny about this prediction to me is Beleg Tal is not the first person I've seen to make that exact joke this week.
Oh, really?
Wait, like I saw someone on our Discord make a, oh, Jeremy's surname is Clifford. Is he related to the Carmine Beast? Like, same thing. And what's funny about it, this, we didn't learn Jeremy's surname here. We've known it since, like, yeah, the start of the story.
Why did it come up suddenly?
Oh, it's just funny that, like, it got re-referenced. And I think, like, because this actually came up, again, on our Discord, like, 2 weeks ago. Somebody was live reading. And I, like, noted that I'd forgotten what Jeremy's last name was. And somebody posted that it was Clifford.
Mm.
And I made the same joke as well.
Nice.
And then it was, like, funny because I went back and it was like, we've known this since 3.6. Why did none of us... Did we all make this joke eight months ago and forget?
It's the classic thing that Wildbo does, where all the pieces were there in front of your eyes the whole time. But sometimes it just takes the right little nudge for it all to fall into place and for the mysteries to be revealed.
Yeah, I guess because I think when we originally learnt it, we were learning like a bunch of classmates' names. And so just like maybe it got glossed over. And Jeremy wasn't as important a character then as he is now.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think it was funny because like, myself included, a bunch of people made the same joke when we saw his surname here, but it's like, we've known this was his surname for ages.
I don't like how you're referring to this very bold and specific prediction as a joke, Elliot, all right? It's legit.
Sorry, Beleg Tal.
Yeah, shame on you. Anyway, did you have a prediction that obviously is not going to be as good, but, you know, might as well talk about?
Yeah, I had one from Lapsed Classicist who sort of...
Lapsed Classicist is like... top tier predictor, you know, kind of
they're definitely like one of the highest appearance rates,
you know. How they wait, I can't remember if this is something that's correct or not. I was gonna say, you know how they give nicknames to the people who submit questions a lot on My Brother, My Brother and Me, but now I think you don't actually listen to My Brother, My Brother and Me for some reason.
No, I didn't know about that.
That's something they do. So anyway, maybe because Lapsed Classicist has submitted so many questions, we need to give them a cool nickname like, sorry, not questions, predictions. We should give them a cool nickname like the Oracle Lapsed Classicist or something, you know.
Oh, I see. Well, God, I don't remember how many of them. Wait, what if they've all been wrong? What if
true.
Like, I haven't kept track. I don't know which ones we pulled out.
The worst Oracle Lapsed Classicist.
the false Oracle. I don't know. I'd have to double check how well they've actually done because I never remember what the actual predictions were. Sorry, but anyway, yes. Yeah, so Lapsed Classicist has basically talked about how they think Edith, now that Edith has like sworn to not name Marisica and try to sort of pretend as if she's the lead culprit. Lapsed Classicist thinks maybe the Kenneteers will like accidentally forswear Edith or something, like because if they catch the girl by candlelight and sort of demand her tell them like who she's on a team with, like she might sort of be basically forced to either like forswear herself or like if she's in a situation where she's properly bound, I think she's compelled to answer. So like maybe the Kenneteers will sort of accidentally forswear Edith. So yeah. Lapsed Classicist basically suggests what if they accidentally forswear her?
Yeah.
And it would tie into what Marisica was saying about how Edith always runs towards her own doom.
Oh, that would be so sad.
I think like, the worst part about that is like you know that would gut the Kenneteers as much as anyone else.
And presumably, I just know that Matthew's going to come into this situation at the worst possible time. Regardless of what happens, Matthew's going to walk in right at the worst time and they're just going to have to fight him at least temporarily and it's going to be fucking horrifying.
Hopefully, I would like to trust Matt enough that if they're like, she had the furs, ask her yourself. And then he could be like, Edith, did you have something to do with it? When she can't say no.
Yeah, but Elliot, what if Matthew comes in right after the Kennedys have accidentally just killed Edith? Like,
oh, I see. Yeah, that probably wouldn't go down great.
I don't know.
It's always with this world, because people have to tell the truth. There's always that part of you that's like, if everyone just takes 5 seconds to talk and they can just like clearly state their motives, you think it should be fine.
Yeah, like, no, I think you underestimate how well Wildberg can set up horrifying situations. Yeah,
exactly.
But yeah, I really like this prediction. I think it's very on point. I think it's definitely a possibility that Edith is basically just going to be fucked by the conflicting forces and be fully a casualty of the crossfire here.
Yeah, I think maybe the one reason, I don't know how it works, but like if the Kennedys bind her and they say, tell us who your like co-conspirators are, maybe she can just say, I can't answer that because of other oaths.
Mm.
And then I don't know if they can force her, but like they probably wouldn't, knowing the Kennedys, they're good enough people that they won't kill her.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see.
We will see. But that's, I guess, the end of our show. We've got a discussion question that we're running at the moment, which is talking about if Kennet is about redefining roles and societal kind of norms, where might witch hunters fit into this? If you have an answer to that, you can leave it in our discussion threads that will be linked in the show notes down below, or, of course, just leave your thoughts on these chapters or the show in general or any of our great predictions or any of that other stuff. Sonic OCs, they can go in there too. Anything else, just pop it in the discussion thread.
Yeah. Also check out our Twitter. That's where you get all the updates on like why this episode is late, because I mean, well, you can probably hear in my voice why this episode is late.
Yeah, because you're possessed by the dooms.
Yeah. So anyway, you would have known that even earlier if you followed us on Twitter.
Yep. If you want more great content from the Doof Media Network, you can go to doofmedia.com. One of the things that is now available on there that I am absolutely thrilled about is we have started releasing one of our Patreon exclusive shows, The High Ground, my personal favorite of all the shows that we do, as a free for everybody. You'll be 6 months behind the Patreon exclusive episodes, but you'll get the episodes just a bit late. And there are two of the episodes as well as a kind of High Ground origins there.
Yeah. Also, that one's not out till a couple of days after this episode, but yes, coming very soon to that feed.
Oh, sorry, I thought it was already out. My mistake.
No, it's just scheduled. That one will be coming out. That is our own origin story, which is our old Media MD episode with Georgia on the Clone Wars.
That feed is just episodes. It's just an amalgamation of episodes from other places. So how old is that High Ground? Because like, so obviously we talked about the Clone Wars with Georgia, who obviously now does the High Ground with us, and that was like what, 2 years ago or something, right?
Probably just over a year ago.
Oh, okay, my mistake.
Yeah,
I just find that funny that the feed is already episodes that are 6 months behind, and then we put one that's like from a year and a half ago or whatever. I mean, it's thematically it makes sense. I just think it's hilarious.
It's our own prequel story, because it was during the recording of that episode that Georgia and I found out you hadn't even seen the movies.
Yeah.
And that was where the idea for the show came from.
Yeah, the loose premise of The High Ground is we start out by watching the Star Wars prequel films, and then we just kind of go on to watch films that are in the same kind of thematic vein of like movies that are kind of terrible, but you love them anyway, I guess is how I would classify it.
Yeah, not like so bad it's good, but kind of this is bad but also good.
Yeah, exactly. Like you love it despite because it's of its flaws. Genuinely, I really love that show that we do. So I strongly recommend people check it out. It's just like the most bonkers nonsense vibes, which really gels with me. Of course, we wouldn't be doing that show if not for our patrons. If you want to become a patron, go to patreon.com/doofmedia. Not only can you support the creation of all these great shows, but you can get bonus shows every single week, including up-to-date episodes of The High Ground, as well as all kinds of other perks that you can read about on that website.
Yep, and don't forget to head to patreon.com/wildbow, because, you know, this podcast and this story would not exist without him. For obvious reasons. So
yes,
go throw him a bone.
Indeed. And with that, we'll catch you next time.